Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, keep calm and carry on, folks. As the stock market turmoil spreads across the globe, the advice is to...
play it nice and cool, son. Nice and cool, you know what I mean?
But what's causing it and how concerned should we be? Because we're a positive bunch here, we'll also be looking at the shares that have rocketed recently. We answer a reader query about inheriting state pensions, we look at the best way to clear your buy-to-let loan, and discover how to bag a property bargain. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, stock markets around the world tumbled this week, at home dropping 6% since the start of October. Investors have been left wondering, well, how much worse can things get? Especially as even some of the FTSE stars have taken a rather big tumble, and it seems to be across the board, from the big house builders, airlines, clothing companies and tech firms, to the smaller investor darlings like Purple Brick and Fevertree, down about a quarter in 3 months. So what on earth is going on, and what should, if anything, you be doing as an investor right now? Welcome, Simon. Explain what's been happening.
Well, after a fairly prolonged period of time in which things were just going up, things have stopped just going up and have now been going down, and going down quite spectacularly, really. We had a week recently that saw a sea of red on the markets. The FTSE All Share, which is the broadest measure of the UK market, as we record this podcast, it was down roughly 7% since the start of October. That is a hefty fall for any month. It's down just over 10% from its peak in spring this year. If a stock market falls by 10%, that's what's generally called a correction. If a stock market falls by 20% from its peak, that's when you start to see people talking about entering something called a bear market. A bear market is when things are going down. A bull market is when things are going up. Now, what has been unusual about the run that stock markets around the world have been on, perhaps less so the UK stock market, which has been held back by a number of factors, although actually did manage to get a boost after the Brexit vote because the pound fell. And generally, when the pound falls, the value of the FTSE goes up, because there are lots of, it's dominated by big companies that earn lots of money overseas. And if you translate that overseas earnings back to pounds and pence after the pound has fallen in value, then it ends up with what looks like higher profits because it's more money in sterling. Now, obviously, it's not actually more money. It's just a change in the exchange rate. But that did lead to the FTSE rising. But if you look at the American market, for example, it's just been chugging along, an upward line. And we've not seen the number of corrections that you would expect to see. You'd normally expect to see a kind of 10% correction about once a year. That's considered to be fairly healthy. You don't actually want markets to just be going up in a straight line. That's not considered to be healthy. But we haven't seen those corrections. It's also been a long, long time that shares have generally been on the rise after the post-financial crisis.
Because so much seems to have been going, well, wrong. It depends how you look at it. But, you know, Trump, we've got Brexit, political and economic storms, and it seems to have just gone, not bothered.
I mean, one of the things that you can point at is low interest rates around the world, the amount of cheap money pumped into the system, things like quantitative easing that involved creating money, buying bonds. You've just seen this wall of money thrown at everything since the financial crisis in order to try and get the recovery going. And then finally, of course, you have actually seen the recovery get going. The UK economy is doing okay. It's doing fine, especially when you consider all the things that are weighing down on us. The US economy is doing pretty damn well. Inflation, which we were worried about being too low for a long period of time, has picked up. It's running at just above 2%, sort of in those major economies. Wages are now starting to go up a bit as well, more so in the States than they are here. But even here, we've seen an uptick in this. So things just generally look okay. And we had this long period that was called the Goldilocks period. Not too hot, not too cold. Not because a young girl broke in, stole your food, broke your bed and then ran off. That meant that there wasn't a pressure to start raising interest rates. Now, you asked why have things started to fall off.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a number of villains of the piece here that fingers get pointed at. There's Donald Trump's trade wars. He's gone into battle against China. He's ramped up tariffs on a number of Chinese imports because he thinks that China is jostling too much for a dominant position and he wants to put the US back ahead. His concern is that the Chinese economy is ultimately soon going to grow to be bigger than the American economy. China's going to have more heft on the international stage and he wants to put a stop to that and he wants America to be great.
Does he have a point? And not about, you know, making America great again. America's all right. But in terms of China?
China's got a plan.
Right.
And China's plan involves doing stuff for China.
China first.
China first,
no.
Yeah. It's got this kind of this Belt and Road plan that's involved expanding out into sort of infrastructure across large areas of the world. It's stretching even as far as South America, for example. Now, obviously, if you are in the American administration and you have a certain way of thinking, then you might start to find this concerning. So this is what lies behind the kind of trade war stuff.
Yeah.
You've then got the Federal Reserve in the US raising rates much quicker there than they are over here. And they're expected to keep going up. And that's because it's trying to stave off what it sees as the threat of inflation. And it thinks that the threat of inflation has got greater due to the actions of the president. One, from the trade war thing, because that actually pushes up the price of things. Mm. Because China obviously retaliated with tariffs as well. And the American tariffs raised the price of buying things from overseas. Secondly, also because of the tax cuts that Donald Trump's brought in, which pumps more money into companies, people's pockets and so on. You had Donald Trump come out the other week and say the Fed was going loco, which is interesting. Perhaps the days of central bank independence are starting to come to an end. In the UK, you've got people pointing to Brexit. But really, ultimately, what's going on here is this concern that rates are going to go up quicker than thought, inflation might come back, and that everything might not be so peachy, that we're not necessarily in this Goldilocks scenario anymore. And so you've got investors who are slightly worried and selling out of things. And one of the things that have been suffering the most are things where the value has been chased up very, very high and people have been willing to pay higher and higher prices for certain companies.
Where are we looking at?
If you wanted to take a look at big companies that have seen their value chased up because people are buying the idea of future growth, the Facebooks, the Teslas of this world, the Amazons and so on, closer to home, if you look at perhaps smaller companies, one that has been bought by investors in this country and done very well for them is a company called Fevertree, the posh gin and tonic.
Yep.
Posh tonic maker and other posh soft drinks.
Ginger beers and
sodas. Yeah, exactly. And it's done phenomenally well. And the share price has risen by a huge amount. But recently it's taken a bit of a tumble. It's down about 25% from its peak. And there's not really anything that's actually triggered that. If you look into the story, there's not one thing you can put your finger on. You can't say that Fevertree's come out and given a profits warning or anything like that. It just appears to be that people have gone, hang on a minute, maybe these shares are too expensive. I mean, they're still expensive. It would still have to grow by an awful lot to justify that price. But what you're seeing is a number of these companies that that's happening to. You mentioned Purple Bricks before. Purple Bricks is a fixed fee online estate agent, substantially cheaper than using a high street agent in many cases. And investors have bought into this growth story because Purple Bricks has expanded very, very rapidly. It's moving into other countries. It's moved into America as well. And then all of a sudden, it too has taken a bit of a tumble because people have just gone, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I'm not willing to pay the price that this growth story has previously been justifying. Maybe I'm only willing to pay a price that is, you know, a notch lower, that's 20% lower.
I'm wondering if the Fevertree, though, has anything to do with stats coming out. Young people are drinking less. Perhaps investors are thinking, you know, regulation, budgets, all that sort of thing. Perhaps alcohol's, you know, off the agenda. Who knows?
Maybe.
And who's willing to pay £800,000 for just a tonic water? But anyway, so where then is a sort of safer place to go? And how long do you think this is going to go on for?
Well, the main concern for most investors, I think, is not the fact that the market has fallen 10% from its peak.
Yeah, because you said this is pretty normal, right?
Yeah, that's pretty normal. That's to be expected. It could easily regain that. Just be patient. Things will go back up. One of the concerns for some of them will be the fact that a lot of popular shares have fallen quite substantially. And so when they open their share dealing accounts, or look at maybe some of the funds or investment trusts that they own, actually they will see stuff that's deeper into the red than the stock market is, and that's always a bit worrying. And there's an effect where, say you bought something cheap a long time ago, right, and it's gone up lots and lots and lots and lots and lots, and it suddenly makes up a few £1,000 of your portfolio, perhaps. Now, you could think, but I only bought that for 500 quid and it's gone up loads. Or when you see it down by 20%, you could think, oh, hang on a minute, I've lost £1,000 there. And people see, they see the loss kind of thing. So the concern, I think, for people, though, is not even necessarily that. It's more that this could be the start of a big one. People expect at some point the market's going to fall 20, 30%, you know, 40% even.
Why? Because it's so high?
Because inevitably it always does.
Okay.
There always comes a point where the stock market crashes. It's the boom and bust cycle.
I thought Gordon Brown ended that.
No, he didn't. He just imagined that.
Okay.
Yeah, he got unlucky. A number of things Gordon Brown said throughout his political career have come back to haunt him.
Sorry.
That is one of them. So the worry is there could be the big one. So what do you do? Do you, the Warren Buffettism, be greedy when others are fearful? Do you be greedy now? Others are fearful now. Well, if your concern is that the market might actually fall 30% and we're only down 10% now, you might think it's a bit too early to be greedy when others are fearful. Maybe you want to wait until people are a bit more fearful. But then on the other side of the coin, there's this idea of the melt-up, the final leg up of the stock market boom before you get the bust. And we don't really look like we've necessarily had that. There's this euphoric phase where everybody just starts buying because they think they're going to make lots of money. And if you want to know what that looks like, think back to Bitcoin at the end of last year when everyone just went, but not all you were hearing were conversations from people, I'm making loads of money in cryptocurrency, I'm making loads of money in Bitcoin and things like that. That's the kind of thing you expect around the stock market. You had that dot-com boom, financial crisis peak, a little bit different. But if you think about it, that was what you were getting in the buy-to-let market at that time. And if you look at the financial crisis, you can trace it back to property over here and in the United States. So you might not want to get out completely, but you might be thinking, I want to stay invested. There are a number of things that you can invest in that will try and protect your money to a certain extent. And I mentioned a few of these in my column today. Traditionally, what you do is you'd move more of your money into bonds. And the simple way of doing that would just to buy into a bond fund or to buy into a simple passive fund. Vanguard does this thing called the Life Strategy Fund, and it balances a certain percentage of bonds and a certain percentage of shares.
And why is that better? Why is that safer? Why is that a good idea?
Bonds are considered to be a safer haven than shares because the return on them is more predictable. A company or a government tells you that they will pay you X percent interest per year, and then at the end of that bond's life, they will give you your money back. As long as that company or government doesn't go bust over that period, you will get that money. If you buy a company's share, the share price is dependent on a number of things: how well that company is doing, how well the economy is doing in general, what the sentiment is towards those two things. And the share might pay a dividend, but that dividend could be cut. There's nothing to say that a company has to pay a dividend. It could cut it at any time. So share prices are more volatile. So you put your money into a share, you've got more opportunity to make a profit because the share price could go up, the dividend could go up, but it could also fall. So because bonds are considered to be more reliable, they're considered to be a safer haven. And the safest form of bonds are considered to be the most highest rated government bonds because governments are less likely to go bust and not pay you your money that you are owed. So what usually happens when you get some form of correction, stock market crash, is if you think of this sort of wave of money that just sort of washes around the world, it washes out of the stock market and washes into the bond market because people go, right, I'm going to park it here in this thing that's considered safer and usually acts as a counterweight to shares. So when shares go down, bonds go up. Now, the only problem with that at the moment is that we had record low interest rates, quantitative easing that involved buying huge amounts of government bonds and thus pushed the price up. So the bond market is a place where you want to be a little bit careful where you tread. So I don't know whether the answer to the I want to go safer is to simply just buy a passive fund that just invests in any old bonds that follows a bond index. Personally, I'd be thinking more of an actively managed fund or investment trust where you've got a fund manager who is trying to pick their way through this kind of stuff. And there are a number of them, actually, which, interestingly, did quite well in the financial crisis. Now, you can't guarantee that history is going to be repeated.
Of course.
For example, there is one called Personal Assets Trust. That invests in shares, it invests in bonds, it invests in other assets as well. And its primary sort of raison d'etre is to protect investors' money first and then to make them a return.
Why is that so unique, that concept, to protect first? Is it unique?
No. There are quite a few funds that do this. However, they don't all necessarily do it that well. If you think about it, why are you investing? Are you investing for the most amount of growth? Are you investing for just some growth? Perhaps you only want to beat inflation. Perhaps you want to substantially beat inflation. So not all funds will aim to protect your money. They will say that the job of protecting your money is for you to invest into other funds that do more protection. For example, you hold a certain number of funds that invest in shares, and then you go and buy some funds that invest in bonds as well. But there's some funds and trusts that put those two ideas together, and they'll hold shares and bonds. So they'll give you an element of protection and an element of growth. And they're the kind of fund or trust that you could theoretically just hold one investment. You might not want to just hold one investment, but you might want to spread it around a bit more. But in theory, you could have just one of these. Personal Assets Trust, for example, fell just 3.4% in 2008 before rising 19.4% in 2009. And then there's another investment trust called Ruffer, which managed to position itself to not only dodge the stock market falls of 2008, this was a year in which the market fell sort of 30%, but actually rose 23% that year. So if you were one of the investors in that investment trust, you'd have been laughing, wouldn't you? Everyone else is panicking and worrying about the sky falling in, and your investment's gone up. They held a large amount of the portfolio in index-linked bonds, basically, which went up substantially in value as everybody rushed for the safety element. Now, obviously, the same trick may not be possible again. They were lucky, in a sense. That trust had been positioning itself for bad news to happen and saying something bad's going to happen, something bad's going to happen.
Sure, they wouldn't consider themselves lucky. I'm sure they thought it was very sensible.
No, but investors in that trust in the couple of years running up to that crash would have missed out on the gains that they would have seen if they'd just have been invested in the stock market. There's another couple of examples, funds. There's a fund called Baillie Gifford's Managed Fund. Now, I'm not saying that you should necessarily buy these ones that I've mentioned here, but I've just talked about them as some kind of examples of what you can do. And there's another example of something you can do, which is just really simple, and that's just keep some money in cash. Think holistically about your investments, and instead of just thinking, those are my investments there, and that's my cash there. If you think about the whole thing together, it's like a pie chart, for example. How much money have I got invested in shares? How much money have I got held in cash? And you just use that cash element as the counterweight. And if you want to take less risk, you hold a bit more cash. And then when the market does fall 30%, you've got it ready to dig in and start buying and be greedy when all those other people are panicking.
Absolutely. And the moral of the story then is to keep calm. Mm-hmm. Because remember, not too long ago on Podcast Past, we were talking about how much the share price of those companies that you talked about that fell 30% are now up. And they were up pretty soon afterwards. And I'm not suggesting anything in the past is what's going to happen in the future. And we don't even know that it's going to drop 30% now. However, keep calm, chill out, diversify.
Yep,
and read
all of those
money.
Things. And just remember that most people's attempts to time the market have a tendency to go spectacularly wrong. So do be very careful about trying to do that.
And have a gin and very expensive tonic while you're just watching things go. Okay, so it's not all gloom and doom. Certainly, you've just mentioned there. But also, you've been taking a look, Simon, have you not, at Britain's golden nugget investments. The ones that have gone great guns we're talking about here. So it's not just all right. These are all right. One has even delivered returns of 1,255%. Is that right?
Yes. That's huge.
Yeah, that seems rather large.
That's an unbelievable
Even to the uninitiated
rise.
In investing. Yeah. Where's that come from?
This is a company called Burford Capital. And effectively, it funds litigation. You invest in helping to back lawsuits.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. But it's a major holding of a certain Mr. Neil Woodford. whose fund holds about sort of 5.5% of his fund is invested into Burford Capital. So that's a lot. And it reflects the fact of how well the share price has done over the last 5 years. I mean, 1,255% is astronomical. And the reason why we actually looked into the shares that have gone up by this much was because Burford was flagged in another story we were writing about a company that was launching a retail bond, a mini bond, kind of peer-to-peer way of trying to back lawsuits. And I mentioned to Myron, who wrote this story, oh, there's Burford Capital as well. And we looked into it and we saw how much the share price had gone up. But you've got another couple of companies in here that haven't gone quite up as much, but still by an awful lot. Fulcrum Utility Services, that is in the utilities and regulated gas industry. That is up by 1,000%. Then we also have in the top five.
Did they start really low?
Yeah, and it's a kind of a surprise package element.
Right.
And then obviously turned out to be very, very profitable. And then people just jump in and pile in. And it's an unusual situation.
Yeah.
IG Design Group, Speciality Retail, that's up 798%. Frontier Developments, that's an electronic gaming company, that's up 757%. And Arcontech Group, that does software infrastructure, software, 698%. Now, the thing is, you're highly unlikely to get this kind of return on any companies that you buy. But if you just get lucky, then you might manage to do it. They're all small companies, so they're all more risky. If we just look at Frontier Developments, for example, which is the video game one, it enjoyed a number of smash hits in video games. Now, again, that's a difficult thing to predict, but if suddenly a company does that, then their value goes up substantially. And it aims to launch one major game every year, but its share price spiked in July 2017 after Chinese technology group Tencent announced it had bought a 9% stake in the British firm for £17.7 million. So, you know, all of a sudden something like that happens and boom, it's good news all round.
Do you expect those sorts of companies to do it for the next five, the next 10?
I would find it highly unlikely that any company that rose by that much over the past 5 years would manage to do it again over the next five. But you never know.
You never know indeed.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, away from stock markets and your pensions agony uncle, Steve Webb's been keeping busy answering readers' questions. And then this time round, it's all about inheriting state pensions. So the reader is an 80-year-old who receives a state pension of over $8,000 a year. Their wife, who's 74, gets almost $4,000. And they want to know, if I predecease her, does she not inherit my higher state pension? I would be grateful if you could answer the following question about a widow's pension position. And Steve's answer, please, Simon.
Well, at first, when you look at this, you think, no, of course you can't inherit a state pension. That's gone with you.
Mm.
But this is to do with married couples. And Steve replies that it all depends on when they and their spouse reach state pension age. Before 6th of April 2016, when the flat rate state pension came in, the rules are different to if you reached it after then. Now, in this case, this couple reached it before then. So they come under the old system when the rules on inheritance were more generous than they are now. Under the old state system, there was two bits to your pension. You had your basic state pension, that's currently paid at £125.96 per week, if you made all the contributions that you needed to in order to get the full basic state pension. And then there's the state earnings related pension, commonly known as SERPs. This is the thing that people could contract out from and is hugely complicated and has caused all kinds of problems with flat rate pensions. But Steve explains the inheritance rules are different for each component. So with the basic pension, he said, I assume you're getting a full basic state pension, but from the figures that you've supplied, it looks as though your wife is getting a reduced state pension at around 60% of the full rate, and almost certainly based on your record of contributions. If you were to die before your wife, she would be able to claim a full basic state pension based on your record of contributions. I'd expect this to be the full rate of £125.95 per week, or £6,549 per year, instead of the £3,976 she currently receives. So that's some good news in the fact that this lady could inherit her husband's pension. Steve then says, but your pension also includes an element for SERPs. Deducting the full basic state pension from the total figure you've supplied, I would assume your SERPs pension is roughly £1,719 per year. If you were to die, your wife would also receive a percentage of this amount. The exact percentage that could be inherited depends on your date of birth and ranges between 50% and 100%. Given you're 80 years old, you're presumably born in around 1938, I would expect from the table your wife would inherit 90% of your SERPs amount, which is £1,546. If the couple were under the new system and the pension was built up at April 2016 was the flat rate, it would now be £164.35 a week. The excess is called a protected payment. 50% of this can be inherited. Special rules apply to women who paid the reduced married woman's stamp. Hugely complex. You can see why people have so many questions about pensions, can't
you? I'm listening to you now and I think, you know what, I back myself, Simon. I think I'm not a stupid person. I've got a few degrees and I'm sort of listening to you. I mean, there's an engagement thing as well because it's a lot of numbers, it's a lot of confusion. Does it really need to have to be so difficult? That is really complicated. As an average person, trying to figure out what all that means, what you're entitled to. And at advanced years, when you really can't be bothered to have to go through all this stuff, is there any way that you can find this stuff out that doesn't involve having to go to This Is Money and asking a former pensions minister?
Yeah, I mean, you can go to gov.uk and start trying to find things out there. You can get your state pension forecast, for example. If you're already getting your pension, you know how much you're getting. If you're really struggling with this kind of thing, I'd recommend going to seeing someone like Citizens Advice. Or if you've got a relative who's struggling with this kind of thing, help them out. But no, it doesn't necessarily need to be so complicated. And actually, under the new flat rate system, it's not as complicated. But where the flat rate system has caused extra complication is because of when it was brought in this transition period. Once we're out of that, once our generation are getting their state pension, hopefully we do get a state
yeah,
pension.
Yeah, absolutely.
But once our generation are getting the state pension, it will be considerably easier because we won't have these sort of some bits here and some bits there kind of thing going on.
All right then, Simon, thank you very much. But let's move on from that because as we've spoken about on Podcast Past, this is the year that the first tranche of home buyers who use the Help to Buy scheme to get on the property ladder have to start paying interest. Now, what is the best way, a lot of people will be thinking, to pay off that loan? Now, remortgaging makes sense, but with more and more lenders creating these specialist Help to Buy deals, picking the best option, I imagine, can feel like a bit of a minefield. So let's take a look now at Yorkshire Building Society's offering their new Next Step mortgage and how that stacks up. But first, why is this year so particularly significant? Remind us about the Help to Buy scheme, Simon.
The Help to Buy scheme involved, the Help to Buy new build scheme involved lending people up to 20% of the value of a brand new home, and it meant that they could then buy it with a 5% deposit from themselves, 20% borrowed interest free from the government, and that interest free loan lasted for 5 years. After that 5 years, you could continue with that loan, but you had to start paying interest to the government on it. So the first wave of people are now getting to the end of their 5 years. Within that 5 years, when it was interest-free, it was highly unlikely many of them were going to try and clear that Help to Buy loan. Probably just maybe if they took a two-year fix, maybe just remortgage to another Help to Buy mortgage. Maybe they took a five-year fix in the first place. But now, if you're coming off to the end of your mortgage, or you're at that end of that five-year period, you're going to be thinking, well, hang on a minute, maybe I'll get rid of this Help to Buy thing and just take a normal mortgage. The good news for people is that there are a lot more low loan-to-value mortgages around now than there were 5 years ago, 95% mortgages and 90% mortgages in particular. And with a bit of a rise in house prices and having spent 5 years paying off their mortgage, a number of these people will, in theory, be able to just remortgage to a 90% mortgage, clear the Help to Buy element and move on. And Yorkshire Building Society has launched a special mortgage at up to 90% for these kind of people.
Why is it special?
Well, it's called it a Next Step mortgage and is available exclusively to Help to Buy borrowers. But really, if you look at it, you can kind of just compare it to a normal 90% mortgage because you can't just pay off some of your Help to Buy government loan with this, which is called staircasing. So say you go, right, well, I can't afford to pay off the full 20%, I'll pay off 5% of it. So ultimately, you could just take a normal 90% mortgage, but it has some bonuses thrown in, like fee-free elements and things like that. But it's at 2.05%, which is reasonable. It's got a product fee of £495, but has this range of additional features, free valuation, free legals, £150 cash back and so on. Now, if you look at rival mortgages, some of them are cheaper than this. HSBC, for example, has a 90% mortgage at 1.79% with a £999 fee. Atom Bank has a two-year fix at 90% at 1.86% with a £900 fee. Now, if you work out the fees versus rate thing, we've got a calculator that you can do that with. This is money.co.uk/calculate. Or you can work out what kind of mortgage you might be able to apply for. This is money.co.uk/mortgage-finder. You'll probably see that actually you might be better off just taking a standard mortgage. Mm. What it does do, though, is get people thinking about, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I could actually get rid of this Help to Buy loan.
Good luck to you if that is you. But let's, because I said we are positive, so let's take a look at if you are looking to buy at the moment. Apparently, there's never been a better time to bag a property bargain, according to experts, with research showing 40% of homes for sale have seen their original asking prices cut. So, Simon, never been a better time to bag a property bargain. That's quite some statement. Is this just an issue of estate agents or people overpricing houses when they put it to market and actually they're really not worth that?
Well, you could argue that if a house hasn't sold for a certain price, then it's not worth that price, yes.
Yeah.
But what's
chancing their luck, though.
Yes. What's going on at the moment is there's a bit of a buyer's strike in the property market. In some areas, it's more pronounced than others. So in London and the commuter belt, the previously red-hot market of the commuter belt, if you talk to estate agents, they don't sound like they're expected to sell any properties until after Brexit. But if you are thinking of buying, it's not a bad time to do so, because most of the properties coming onto the market now are coming onto the market for less than they were coming onto a year ago, certainly in London and the commuter belt. And the sellers might be being quite a bit more realistic on the price, rather than going, oh, well, I was going to go 25, 50 grand more than this and then give people a little bit of room for manoeuvre. They're going, right, OK, I'll just sell at this price and I want to put it on at that price. And you can negotiate a bit harder. We're at the point of peak uncertainty, I would argue, about Brexit. And so people are worried about buying. But if there's not a queue of people waiting to buy, then you might be able to get yourself a better deal. Arguably, the best time to buy is when other people don't want to, because then people selling stuff are willing to negotiate more and give you a better price. And perhaps that person selling is moving to a bigger property. Inevitably, a lot of people are. And if they are moving to a bigger property, they too can also negotiate and they might be able to get a bit more money off. And we had a look at the places with the biggest reductions. Amongst those is London, where the reduction, that's in sixth place. The average reduction from the original asking price is 6.89%. But because prices are high in London, that represents a whopping great £64,661. Then in number one place, we've got Bradford. Mm-hmm. There, the average percentage reduction is 7.77%. But that only equates to £10,738. We have got Newcastle, a place that you know well.
I do, indeed.
That is in spot number three. That's got an average reduction of 7.18%. That represents £13,700. And then in second spot, we have Mitcham in Surrey.
Yes.
7.45%, average reduction there of £47,000. And we spoke to Henry Pryor, who is a buying agent. So what he does is he acts for the people trying to buy a property and he tries to find properties for them and then negotiate on them. And he said, in 34 years in the business of buying and selling property, I haven't seen a better time to bag yourself a bargain. No market likes uncertainty and the housing market is no exception. If you prepare yourself properly, ensure that you have your finances together, have a lawyer standing by and are prepared to negotiate, then it's possible to negotiate 10 to 20% off the asking price. Obviously, it does depend on how high the asking price was in the first place. If you think that that person has actually priced their property quite realistically, then you're probably not going to manage to get that off. And it depends how much they want to move. You know, maybe they can afford to sit there and wait.
Well, imagine if you're selling at this time, then people are pretty desperate, because otherwise you probably, if you could wait, you would wait. If that's the recommendation that people
maybe
can negotiate at 10, 20.
I mean, maybe, or alternatively, you might just be thinking, well, I actually want to move and I'm thinking that I can basically, this is a good time for
everyone's
me to move.
Everyone's thinking they can bag a bargain, right?
Because I can bag myself a bargain. So you're like, right, if I can just get my place sold for a certain amount, then I can buy another place. So you're not necessarily desperate. But he went on to say, estate agents themselves admit that 85% of homes are selling for less than the asking price. My own view is that if the agent isn't weeping when you make an offer, then you're offering too much.
Great advice.
Metaphorically speaking,
obviously.
I believe.
Thank you very much, Simon. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have bagged yourself a bargain, let us know. We'd love to hear it. If you have any questions you want our pensions expert, Steve Webb, to answer, or indeed any other issues, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk or tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney and go to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast where you can find all the podcasts past.
And if you do like our podcast, please do rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.